Hey, Allison.
Hey, Max.
How you doing?
I'm great.
I just wanted to let you know, so be aware, that coming very soon, there's going to be some very special things happen on the Patreon.
Oh, man.
We just got a new intern. His name is Vic. Welcome to the team.
Hooray, Vic.
And we have some special stuff coming. So stay tuned. Do you remember the website?
Patreon.com/UrsulaMajor.
That's exactly right.
I got to get on it.
Hello.
Hi, everyone.
And welcome to The Bitchery of History. My name's Max.
I'm Allison.
And this week, I'm going to be talking about Rita Moreno.
Ooh. Yes. I am going to be talking about Nuwan Yarua.
Ooh.
Get excited.
I don't know who that is, but I'm excited.
Well, Nuwan Yarua was a Nigerian elder who instigated and kind of started up a short war in Nigeria that is considered one of the first, if not the first, major challenges to British authority in West Africa during the colonial period.
Yes. Oh, I know. I'm already here for this.
You are going to love it. So there's not much known about her early life. Her fame comes from a confrontation that she had with the British. And so it's from the British records that most of the information that we have about her comes from, of course.
Sure.
The war that she kind of was a major player in, shall we say, is referred to sometimes as the Aba Women's Riots or the Women's War. I know. Women in the Igbo land had a significant role in politics. They were expected to participate in village meetings. They had strong solidarity groups. Men and women worked very closely together in the household as well. And they were recognized to have truly separate but equal roles in any
This is a trend for Northern Africa, we've found. Yeah.
In 1914, the British colonized the area and decided to put in place a new political system.
Great.
As they do.
Yep.
So in 1914, the British colonized the area, deciding to put in place a new political system without checking with any of the natives per usual. They saw the previous system with women participating as just, quote, a manifestation of chaos and disorder, end quote.
Jesus.
So under the new system that England put in, warrant chiefs were established to lead the Igbo people. And over the course of time, they became slowly more and more oppressive. They also began to shut the women completely out of having any political power. And of course, prior to this, women had a decent amount of power. They were allowed to reject any marriage proposal. They had a lot of their of agency that these new warrant chiefs were taking away. In 1925, the British then conducts a census of all men and their possessions and puts a tax system in place. They had originally said, oh, we're just collecting information. We're not going to put a tax system in place. Oh, wait, haha, a few months later, here's a tax system. Bye.
Psych.
Yeah, psych, exactly. At this point, only the men were taxed, but the women were affected because they're part of the household and the men were being taxed, and so problems.
I've been rolling my eyes for the last like 3 minutes.
I know, but it gets better.
Okay, good.
So in late October 1929, an elderly woman named Nuwan Yarua, who was a widow, was approached by a census taker who demanded that she count her animals and family members. And she says to him, quote, was your widowed mother counted, end quote, which was taken to mean that women don't pay taxes in traditional Igbo society. So the two exchange angry words. There's even some speculation and the possibility that there was some pushing and shoving involved.
Good for her.
Right? Nuwan Yarua was angry and told the women's network in her city. And they planned a protest and they wrote a message on palm leaves to other women in neighboring villages to encourage them to pass the message on. So Nuwan Yarua, quote, rang the bell that summoned the women of Eastern Nigeria together. And in November, over 10,000 women gathered outside the district administrative office to protest the tax.
Yes.
Over 10,000 women.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
In 1929 in Africa. Okay.
That's an incredible feat.
They demanded that the warrant chief give them a written assurance that they wouldn't be taxed. And they sat outside his office for several days. until he eventually did give them a written assurance after he was ordered to by British officers. Nwani Rua played a major role in keeping the protests nonviolent as well. She was much older compared to those who were leading the protests, but under her advice, the women protested through song and dance and sitting on the warrant chiefs.
Because women would rather not fight if they don't have to.
Because it is generally the smarter choice, especially for the long game.
I think women also have a certain degree of empathy throughout history that men have been told they shouldn't have.
Yes. Two sides to every coin.
Exactly.
Beautifully put, Max. So as the protests spread, other groups came to Nwanyi Rua to write down the results of the protest in her city. And she said to them, quote, "Women will not pay tax till the world ends and chiefs were not to exist anymore." End quote. And the ultimate mic drop.
Seriously.
So good.
It's never going to happen.
Until the world ends and there are no more chiefs.
From Game of Thrones, until the mountains something like blow in the wind like leaves or something like that.
Maybe.
When Khal Drogo dies.
Spoiler. She was brought money from many women to thank her for preventing them from having to pay the tax. So people are almost essentially then paying her the taxes instead, right. Which I think is beautiful. Then the warrant chief took several of the protesters, the women protesters, hostage, and he harassed them in just a big show of power, basically. But the campaigns continued protesting, now demanding that the chief be removed. And 2 days later, the British removed the chief and he was sentenced to 2 years imprisonment.
Oh my God.
Right? So as news of what the women were doing and what they were able to achieve spread, women all across the Igbo land started to organize and make the same demands.
Light that fire.
So the protest grew from the one small women's network and spanned across two provinces over 6,000 square miles. Again, 1929.
Yeah.
In
Africa. I'm with you.
So this campaign came to be called the Women's War because the women were, quote, making war on the men and sanctioning the men who had been disrespectful.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I love it. Now, the really cool thing, or one of the cool things about this, is that it's actually considered a traditional form of protest among Igbo women. This sitting on a man is when a man was disrespectful, he would be followed everywhere and forced to think on what he had done. And his hut would be burnt as a punishment.
Oh my God. You might as well have a right? bell going, shame.
So in many cases, shame. Women would gather outside of the man's compound and sing and dance while detailing the women's grievances against him and burning his hut to the ground.
That's truly amazing.
It's so amazing. I want to see it.
Public shaming.
Oh my God. Can we get women from Eastern Nigeria to come to DC?
I don't know that it would work.
We could try. Edit this out so the NSA doesn't come after me. Joking, NSA, joking. The British didn't know this custom of the women's protest, and so they called in police officers and troops. They'd never witnessed protests on this scale in any other part of colonized Africa.
Oh, yeah.
So according to some sources, the protest was completely nonviolent. Others say that the women did loot and destroy property and beat up some of the chiefs, destroying their homes. But the British forces were just taken by surprise by the number of women who turned out for the protest. They did start shooting at the protesters. They killed at least 50 and injured 50 more.
God.
And that's the numbers that we have.
Right.
Again, Africa, 1929. Don't really know all the details.
Right.
Despite the casualties, the protest is actually considered a success, and it did mark significant gains for the Igbo people. Several warrant chiefs stepped down or were forcibly removed, and some were even replaced by women.
Yes.
The women's war was very instrumental in marking the rise of gender ideology, offering women who are not married to elites the opportunity to engage in social actions through the protest.
Oh, cool.
And it also encouraged more protests that continued well into the 50s. So almost another 20
Whoa.
Years. The women's war has been described by one historian as, quote, the most massive and effective protest in colonial Nigeria, and it affected the whole course of southern Nigerian colonial history.
Wow.
Nwanyi Rua is the name most attributed to the Aba Women's Riots of 1929. due to her initial anger to start the protest and her wisdom to keep it peaceful. However, in local languages, it was referred to as the Women's War, and people have made a push to refer to it as such in order to take the event out of a colonialist mm-hmm. lens and center it on the women involved. Yes. So we don't know too much about her life really before or after, right. but she just, it's that spark at that one time in history that really did light a fire that spread 6,000 square miles.
Right, for like 30 years, 40 years.
About 1929 to the 1950s, yeah, like 25 years.
Fair. Yeah, that's somewhere amazing. In there. Thank you for that story.
Of course.
Fantastic. And
I knew you would love it.
I love stories like that where we don't know too much before and too much after, because it really does highlight, like, sometimes you get into the right place at yeah. the right time and you just have to show up.
Yes.
You just have to show up.
Absolutely.
All right. So, Rita Moreno.
Oh, I'm so excited.
A legend, if there ever was one. So, Rita Moreno was born Rosa Dolores Alverio on December 11th, 1931, in Humacao, Puerto Rico, to Rosa Maria, a seamstress, and Paco Alverio, a farmer. She was originally given the nickname Rosita, and then in 1936, her mother moved to New York City, taking Rita with her, but not her son, Francisco. Rita remembers her move to New York City from Puerto Rico as the opposite of the Wizard of Oz. They moved from a bright, colorful place to a cold place that was all black and white. When she and her mother first got there in February 1936, they moved into an apartment with a distant aunt and 12 other people. Her mother worked three jobs as a seamstress in a factory, cleaning houses and making paper flowers to sell at markets. Once summer hit, they had saved enough money to move into an apartment on their own in Washington Heights, which is amazing. She started taking dance lessons the first year they moved to New York. And when she was 5 years old, she took classes from Paco Cancian, the paternal uncle of film star Rita Hayworth. Right?
Whoa!
Right? She booked dancing gigs in clubs and even danced on the docks as men were being shipped out during World War II.
Oh my God!
To her recollection, the war really didn't mean anything to her, but as she looks back, she says, the last bit of American entertainment many of those boys saw was Little Rosita, with her varnished banana and pineapple towering temple of a headdress, a little girl who danced and sang as a miniature Carmen Miranda.
Aww.
When she was 11, she did voiceovers for the Spanish language version of American films, and then landed her first Broadway role at the age of 13
what?
As Angelina in Skydrift alongside Ellie Wallach. Her performance in Skydrift caught the attention of talent scouts from Hollywood, even though the show only lasted one performance.
Holy cow!
Her big break came when she was cast in an indie film called So Young, So Bad in 1950, alongside two other actresses who would also go on to have fame in Hollywood, Ann Jackson and Anne Francis. The movie was surprisingly successful. The three main creatives behind were blacklisted while the film was in production, and the main actor, Paul Heinried, had to put up 50% of the funding. It was one of the first successful independent movies and is considered a cult classic to this day.
I have not seen it, but it's going on my list.
We should watch it together.
Yes.
After So Young, So Bad, she had an audition with Louis B. Mayer of MGM at the Waldorf Astoria in New York City. He told her that she looked like a Spanish Elizabeth Taylor and signed her to a 7-year contract.
Get it, queen.
Effectively uprooting her whole family from New York to Los Angeles. It was actually an executive at MGM who decided to change her name from Rosa to Rita because her original name was, quote, too Italian.
Which doesn't even make sense because she's from Puerto Rico.
Exactly. Who knows?
Oy. Hashtag colonialism. Right.
Rita acted steadily in films throughout the 50s, but it was usually in small roles. The next really big break came when she was handpicked by Gene Kelly to play Zelda Zanders in the movie Singin' in the Rain. Rita actually disliked most of her film work during this period because she felt her roles were very stereotypical, with the exception of her supporting role in the film version of The King and I, in which she played Tupton. This is when she's at Fox,
Whoa.
Not at MGM. One of my favorite.
I'm just thinking because I've seen The King and I. I mean, I've seen a lot of different movies that she's in, but I just don't even remember her being in that.
I don't either, honestly. Although, I'll be fair, it's been a minute since I've seen The King and I.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a minute. Also, again, Puerto Rico, Indian, like, whatever.
After her first three movies with MGM, all musicals, they ended her contract and fired her. So apparently, they weren't good. They weren't, like, successful. In 1954, she was featured on the cover of Life magazine with the caption, Rita Moreno, an actress's catalog of sex and innocence, which further catapulted her career.
Whoa.
I need to find this magazine and read it.
Oh my God.
According to Rita, after Daryl Zanuck, who's one of the executives, like legendary executives at 20th Century Fox, saw the cover and said, "Who's that girl? Does she speak English? Get me that girl." And signed her to Fox based on that cover alone.
Wow.
In 1961, Rita landed the role we all know her by, Anita, in the film adaptation of West Side Story, for which she ended up winning the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress.
It's been a minute since I've seen that, but I definitely remember her in it.
Same. Oh, wow. When thinking back on West Side Story in a recent interview, Rita remembered how all of the actors portraying Puerto Ricans were forced to wear the exact same makeup. She said, "I remember saying to the makeup man one day, because it was like putting mud on my face. It was really dark, and I'm a fairly fair Hispanic. And I said to the makeup man one day, 'My God, why do we all have to be the same color? Puerto Ricans are French and Spanish. We are very many different colors. We're Taino Indian. We are black, some of us.' And the makeup man actually said to me, 'What, are you racist?' I was so flabbergasted that I couldn't come back with an answer."
I'm so flabbergasted I can't think of anything to say. Facepalm. That's what I'll say.
Exactly. I mean, what do you say?
You can't say anything.
What are you racist?
You say, "Oh, hello. Oh, sorry. Sorry, you're getting a phone call. It's the pot. He wanted to tell you that you're black."
Right, exactly. So Rita thought that West Side Story was going to be her big break. And it was. But at the same time, she didn't work again for another 7 years. She didn't get another movie for seven more years after that, because she was always offered stereotypical Latina roles. She was always barefoot. She was humiliated always when she was, when they were offering her these films to be in. Eventually, she just kind of had to do it. She did appear in one film during her hiatus from Hollywood, which was called Cry of Battle in 1963. But it had been filmed right before she won the Academy Award. So it doesn't really count in terms of that kind of
timeline.
Exactly. She makes her return in 1968 with the film The Night of the Following Day and followed it with a string of movies. So Poppy comes in 1969, Marlowe in 1969 also, Carnal Knowledge in 1971, The Ritz in 1976, and then The Four Seasons in 1981, which is a pretty good string of movies, especially for the 1960s and 70s.
Yeah.
In the late 70s, she appeared in a number of plays and musicals, including The Ritz, for which she won the 1975 Tony Award for Best Featured Actress, right? So we're working on getting up to that EGOT level.
Oh, yeah.
On TV, she takes a break from the screen. She goes into TV instead. She was a main cast member on the PBS show The Electric Company from 1971 to 1977. She and the rest of the cast won a Grammy Award in 1972. For the show's soundtrack. She made numerous guest appearances on shows like The Muppet Show, The Love Boat, The Cosby Show, George Lopez, The Golden Girls, and Miami Vice. I mean, honestly, she got around. One notable guest appearance was a three-episode arc on The Rockford Files in 1977 as a former call girl named Rita Kapkowicz. She won an Emmy Award for Outstanding Guest Actress in a Drama Series. She also won an Emmy for her appearance on The Muppet Show.
Oh, I'm gonna cry. So she's a EGOT.
Yeah, honestly. Yeah, so she has two Emmys, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony. Yeah, which is incredible. She also, I think, is one of the only people who's done it really close into each other. So she got it within like 10 years or something like that. Mm. Most of the time with people get EGOT, they get it over like the course of their careers eventually.
Yeah.
In her personal life, Rita carried on an 8-year-long affair with actor Marlon Brando.
What?
A romance that literally almost killed her. She also revenge dated other such famous men as Dennis Hopper and Elvis Presley in order to make Brando jealous.
I need a biography of her yesterday. I had no idea. Holy cow.
I didn't either until I saw this research.
My mind is falling out of my ears because it's exploded.
She married Leonard Gordon, a cardiologist who also became her manager in 1965. And he unfortunately passed away in 2010. Hmm. The two of them do have one daughter, Fernanda Fisher, and two grandsons, Justin and Cameron Fisher.
Aww.
Rita said in regards to raising a daughter that she brought her up, quote, to understand that she is worth everything she had and that love is something that you give freely and is not conditional. My daughter understands that she is respected and admired and that her opinion matters.
Mm,
she is still alive and working today.
Did you see her Kennedy Center Honors thing?
Yes. I watch the Kennedy Centers every year.
Crying.
Oh, so good.
Let's take a break and talk to you about our sponsors, Audible.com.
You can start a free trial and get a free audiobook by going to audibletrial.com/bitchery.
Speaking of learning new things,
yeah.
Have you ever heard of the book The Heart is a Lonely Hunter?
No.
It's fairly well known. I think it's on a decent amount of reading lists, high school reading lists, college reading lists, that sort of thing. And I have always heard of it, so I recognized the title this morning, but I didn't know it was written by a woman, Carson McCullers, who was 23 at the time it was published in 1940.
That's so
cool. And
you
can get it on audible.com. Yes.
audibletrial.com/bitchery. Hey, y'all. If you're enjoying the podcast, do Allison and myself a favor by looking down at the phone or the computer you're listening to this podcast on and giving us a rating or a review. Those ratings and reviews help other people find the podcast, which helps us keep doing the podcast. Thanks. All right. So today in herstory?
Absolutely. On June 4th, 1917, Laura E. Richards, Maud H. Elliott, and Florence Hall received the first Pulitzer for biography for their work about their mother, Julia Ward Howe. She was a poet and a suffragist.
Mm-hmm. Also on June 4th, but in 1919, 2 years later, Congress approved the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, which guaranteed suffrage to women and sent it to the United States, the states, for ratification.
What?
Yes.
Then on June 5th, 1915, Denmark amends its constitution to allow women's suffrage.
Yes. It's a big week in women's suffrage.
Absolutely.
So what's our term for the week, Allison?
Our term for the week is Boston marriage. Uh-huh. Have you ever heard that term before?
No, I haven't.
It's one that's kind of thrown around in various conversations. And what it is, it's a term that comes from the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And it describes two women living together independent of the financial support of a man.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of sometimes been used to infer, especially looking at historical records, that perhaps they weren't just independently financially living together.
Let me guess. Lesbian together.
Lesbianing together?
Mm-hmm. Lesbianing.
Is that what you said? Yes. But it also sometimes can be used to refer to just two women who are very close in their friendship.
Oh, like you and Beverly.
Yeah. It's a Boston marriage in a way.
Yes.
But we would make terrible roommates and we've agreed to never live together.
That's cool. I like that there's a term for it.
Mm-hmm.
More than just, hey, they're good friends. No, they're in a Boston marriage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm in a Boston marriage with my roommate.
Yeah. Fantastic. Good.
So what's our cause for the week?
So our cause for the week is women-centered.
Mm.
Women-centered is a platform for progressive, women-centered thought leadership that cultivates personal development and social action.
Hmm.
Designed with busy, forward-thinking women in mind, Women-Centered offers a new model for self-care for you to embrace your innermost personal needs, wishes, and desires while creating meaningful and impactful change within your life and in the lives of women around you. It is amazing.
The self-care is what got me.
What's great about this website, and I've looked around, is when you there's a big button right at the top that says Take Action Now. And when you look at that button, not only does it help you to figure out how to take care of yourself, but it also talks about how you can start petitions about things, how you effectively share things to social media if you want to affect change.
Oh, wow.
How you can call your friends or leave notes for your friends in order to affect change in that kind of way or to help people and that kind of fun stuff.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's actually quite an amazing website. And you can find the website at womencentered.org, womencentered.org.
Thanks, Max.
Of course.
The Bitchery of History is a production of Ursula Major Productions. You can find us online on all your social media sites at UMPBOH.
And then on Facebook, all you have to do is search The Bitchery of History.
We will pop up.
For just a few dollars a podcast or maybe a dollar a day, you can help us make this podcast happen by going to patreon.com/UrsulaMajor.
We could not do this podcast without our amazing production team. Yes. So a special shout out to Olivia,
Ashley.
Jeanette.
Kim.
Seth.
Jeanette.
I already said Jeanette.
Dan.
And Sydney.
And now Vic.
Welcome, Vic.
Our intern.
And as always,
bitches get stuff done.